Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Thanks for making it, man.
I always feel like when I hear Dave speak, so I always feel like I learned something from you. But you know, you predicted the insurrection. I don't know if you know this at Capitol Hill.
Oh yeah, yes I do. I'm very aware of because you're not the. It wasn't the only radio show I did that on. There's like a few different radio shows that I. The only thing I was wrong about was the date. I said it was the day that they make him leave office. He was going to do it. But I mean,
exactly
what happened though, right?
Exactly. Like, dude, I started telling other people that I was like, yo, you know, I heard this comedian speak and he was like, you know, there's going to be like this uprising. It's crazy. And then Trump is going to pretty much say, oh, they're trying to make your president leave, or like they're trying to take your president away, which is exactly what you predicted because he still claimed to be president. And then there was a whole uprising. Dude, that shit blew my mind.
I mean, I didn't think there was anything special about the prediction. It seemed just like common sense to me that there's no way he's leaving. I mean, that was the thing. It seemed to me like it was like, does anyone really think he would leave office without doing this?
It's crazy.
I mean, I didn't think it would be as incompetent as it was. I thought he would do a better job. But this was as good as he could pull off. But I mean, no, but yeah, no, I did. Believe me, I loved the I told you so's because I had a few people right after the insurrection from radio shows like had me call in to be like, wow, this is exactly what happened. And I'm like, yeah, but like, of course it is. Like, he wasn't just going to leave. The only difference was what I said was he's going to, the day he has to leave office, he's going to go on Twitter and say, if you love me, get a gun and come to the White House
now
and stop them from illegally removing your president. And it's essentially what he did.
Yes.
Because, you know, that was always the plan. The plan was always, if I can destroy this country rather than lose it, I will.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
he is everything everyone ever said he was. And he
does he feel like a distant memory now?
No, he's still a major problem in this country. He is the reason we are not vaccinating 30% of the country, because his fans will not get vaccinated simply because they will not go along with anything in society that they feel is not theirs, that they own, that they can do. If liberals are getting vaccinated, that means they won't. And he is the reason that we're going to have a lot of people still dying of this disease. He's very well, and you know, he's going to attempt another insurrection. When he loses the next time, he's going to do this again. He's going to run for president again, and he's going to lose again. And then he's going to try to do this again and try to learn from his previous mistakes. He is the enemy of the United States, and he is going to do everything in his power to destroy this country, to punish it for voting against him.
Wait, if he runs again, is there a strong enough candidate in the Democrat side to go against that guy?
I think it's the opposite. I think if he runs again, any Democrat could win. I think he is such a weak candidate nationally. He is such a weak candidate in a general election that if Biden chose to keep running, if Kamala ran, if someone else ran, I think anyone beats him because his brand is so tainted. It is such a joke now. He has no chance of winning, and he'll do the exact same thing where he'll try to organize a rally and then turn it into a riot, which is what he did. He meticulously organized different groups of people to be there. And then the whole plan was always sick them at the Capitol building and see if I can get them to physically overthrow the government. And what was so pathetic about it is if they succeeded, if they did what they wanted to do, that would have been getting through the rotunda, murdering multiple congressmen, forcing them at gunpoint to make Trump president, and then eventually they would have had to leave the building
and go home
and go home
and validate their parking tickets.
once they leave the building, everything that they did would have been declared nonsense. Nothing would have stayed legal because there was no legal. There's no law that says you can force these things and they're still legally binding. That's insane. Mm-hmm. That's something only a mentally disturbed child could think is reality.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they were just going to go. And here's the, okay, so let's change that for a second. Let's say they hear, okay, well, as soon as we leave, they're going to undo it. So we're just going to live here. We're going to live here forever. And as long as we're living in the Capitol building,
they can't change it.
Whatever laws we make are the laws. Here's the problem with that. What happens the next day? The moment you tell people, well, these 400 people in the Capitol building think that they're in control of the world because they're physically in the building. Why wouldn't, you know, anyone with enough money go kick them the fuck out, slaughter them, and now they're president?
Yes.
You know how many groups of people have the resources to do that in this country? How many private citizens would have the resources to just clear them out and be new president? It's pathetic. These people are idiots. We're literally the stupidest people on earth.
Dave, let me quickly.
Where are those people?
They're all getting charged. They've already charged over 500 of them. QAnon and Trump, and to the same extent, the coalition of thuggish, strong arm, right wing leaders that Putin has been propping up all over the planet, all of them have the same principle.
Yeah.
There are a lot of really bitter, insecure, stupid people in the world, and they all love this. There are so many stupid people out there who are dumb enough to believe you when you say you're not stupid. It's all a trick.
Yeah.
And I even say to defend the Republicans in America, it's not that the Republicans turned crazy as much as people who never voted to begin with became the new Republicans. The kinds of people who never voted because it was always over their heads, they finally simplified politics down to the point that even these people thought they understood it. The whole thing is a manipulation of what's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. The Dunning-Kruger effect is a psychological phenomenon in which the less you know about something, the more you assume you know about something. Meaning, you take any task and you ask a bunch of people from the most knowledgeable to the least knowledgeable, how knowledgeable are you about this subject? Mm-hmm. The people who are the 100% most knowledgeable will say, I think I'm in the 60%. The people who are halfway knowledgeable will correctly guess, I think I'm about halfway knowledgeable. The people in the bottom 10% think they're in the top 90%. The dumber you were, the more you think you're the smartest person there because you're too stupid to know how stupid you are. That's where these people came from. People who are so dumb, they don't realize they don't understand anything they're talking about. That's where the election fraud thing came from.
Yep.
The people who were arguing about election fraud, the one thing we found was similar about them was they were all people who did not understand even the most basic aspects of how votes were counted.
Jeez.
So what they were saying, so what you had was people testifying saying, I saw voter tampering, and say, all right, what did you see? Well, I saw these giant black boxes filled with votes that were just being delivered to the polling place. Like, yeah, those were the votes. And they're like, well, why are they being delivered in these black boxes by random people? Like, they're not random. That was their job. What color do you want the box to be? What the fuck are you talking about? Like, that's what that's what we saw in these trials. And I mean, in these hearings in like Minnesota and in Arizona, where they were trying to argue about voter fraud, and you were like, and I mean, and when they would ask, well, what did you see? They, you know, one woman said, well, the person delivering the votes was Chinese. That was their answer for what was fraudulent. Another person said, I saw stacks and stacks of blank ballots. Like, yeah, of course you did. That's part of the process. You have to have that's part of it. You have blank ballots because when a ballot is damaged, you have to copy it so that the machine can read it. And then you throw out the original, and you do this in front of multiple people from both sides. Mm-hmm. So you know that no one is cheating. My favorite one, though, my favorite proof of voter tampering was when they said they wouldn't let us close enough. Like, what do you mean? He goes, well, the law says you have to be 3 feet away from the person doing the ballot at all times. And like, well, we want to be closer. Like, well, how much closer? They're like, well, we wanted to like touch them. Like, so what you're saying is you think it's voter fraud that you weren't allowed to do stuff to the ballots.
That's illegal.
And really, that's what it ended up being, that they were like, well, we wanted to be left alone with the ballots. It's like, no, that really is what it ended up being. Their argument for what was voter fraud was we, the representatives of one side of the campaign, were never left to do what we wanted alone with these ballots and then be trusted to give them back, which is what they wanted. They wanted to be given custody of the ballots and then trusted to hand them back. It's like, it just goes along with the whole thing. Trump never accuses anyone of anything he isn't doing himself. That's what he does. Whenever he does something, he accuses the other side of doing it.
You know what's amazing about this whole analysis of yours is the fact that when you're sitting outside the US, how little you know about what's going on. All of a sudden, all of us became experts about US voting fraud and how the procedures must go and who should be president or not. But we never really got to hear most of the hearings because we depend on CNN. We don't get Fox over here.
Why would you?
we don't get NBC or ABC, you know, so we get CNN, and all of a sudden overnight became experts in what was wrong with the US.
Well, I mean, the whole planet has to be experts in American politics because it affects you, because American politics affect the rest of the world. Meanwhile, you know, like, that's the sad thing, is like, it's a sad thing in America where like the typical Honduran child can probably name more American leaders than the typical American. I mean, you can name a lot of players in the American political system, and I don't know how many Americans would get it correct if they were asked if South Africa is a country or a continent. You know, we are desperately ignorant of foreign geography in America. But yeah, like, these trials, I mean, it's entertaining from afar. But of course, these are like people who are actually trying to destroy the world, and might have, actually, in terms of climate change, they might have already gone too far. But I mean, did you see the blonde woman who was, everyone pretty much agreed, looked drunk out of her mind, testifying in Minnesota next to Giuliani?
No.
I mean, that was one of the most amazing things we've ever seen. This woman was just so belligerently drunk, seeming. She says she wasn't, but if she wasn't drunk, she's in a lot more trouble. If that's what she's like when she's not drunk, that's a billion times worse. No, this woman's very, very famous thing where she was testifying in Minnesota in front of Republicans. These are Republicans who want her to be correct, who want her to be telling the truth. And she's saying, I personally saw thousands of fake ballots. And I saw ballots being filled out by dead people. And it was like, well, wait a second. What do you mean when you say filled out by dead people? And they're just like, and like, she literally said, like, you could just tell she was making everything up and she was completely full of shit. She was saying, she goes, I saw people on the sidewalk and they were pulling out ballots for Trump and saying, let's get rid of these and replace them with Biden. And it's like, really? People on the sidewalk were just yelling that out? Or, you know, and then he said, he was like, she was like, well, I saw that they were like a lot more votes for to vote for president than there were people in that city. And the guy who's Republican says, well, I got the numbers right here. There were this many votes and it was about 40% of people in the city. And she was like, oh, so you like took the ballots and like destroyed them and now you're part of it. And it was just like, what? And this was Giuliani trying to like calm this woman down. And he's drunk out of his mind too. So Giuliani has been described as a high school drunk. I don't know if you know that term. I'm sure you have those two. But yeah, I mean, it has been the most embarrassing like parade of stupid people in world history. Like during the election, after Biden won, and it was the job of the electors to then go to Washington or go to their state capital and deliver and, you know, just do the formalities of, all right, this person won our district, so here are the electoral college votes for that person. Trump was sending people to their state capitals to deliver the electoral college votes who are not electors. So he was literally sending like random civilians to these state offices just to say, hey, we're here to deliver the electoral votes, hoping that the people who work there would not do what they, of course, did do, which is say, who the hell are you? What are you doing here? What is wrong with you? Because in Trump's world, everyone he works with is incompetent. They're all amateurs.
Yes.
To them, that plan made sense. Like, hey, if someone just showed up here and they said we had to deliver, we would take it. It's like that because they're amateurs.
That's the world he lives in.
Right. And so they thought like the attitude of like, we'll have Pence just say no. And they're like, well, there's no legal recourse for that. If Pence just says no, don't make Biden president, it's not going to make Trump president. It's just going to add a few hours of paperwork while they have to be like, well, the vice president refused. And according to that, it means the speaker of the house has to blank. And like, but to Trump, it was like, yeah, okay, that's enough. A few hours, maybe we'll get lucky. Someone will start getting hanged. And, you know, maybe I'll be president for life. That was his plan. Maybe I'll be president for life. Maybe won't be America anymore. We'll kill Congress. We'll Handmaid's Tale the whole thing. And I'll just be president till I die. And then I can make Ivanka president. Like that really was his plan. That really is what he was thinking. Hey, maybe this will work. Screw it. What's to lose? What's the downside? It was his attitude. I lost the election. Why not try?
Yes. Yes.
We had like Eugene, you could like testify with us that
I'm not going to testify to anything.
Right. And when you worship a con man, the more charges they have against him, the more innocent that means they must be.
Yes.
Because every charge is proof of the conspiracy against them.
Yes. And his closeness with the Russians and Putin was very concerning. It was very, very concerning.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone who tolerates Putin is clearly deeply corrupted. That's just how it is. I mean, look at Australia. Remember, Australia had a ridiculously bad prime minister for a long time. He was the guy who was like, there needs to be a compromise between a woman's right to her own body and a man's right to fuck it. That was a thing that the Australian prime minister said once. I'm paraphrasing. Wow. That's pretty much what he said. I believe it was Abbott. He basically said that he goes, there needs to be a halfway mark between a woman's right to not be raped and a man's right to rape her. We need to come together in the middle.
Well, our former president raped a woman, and then he said she was dressed provocatively in a way, or it's what she was wearing. What do you expect me to do? Remember the whole Kanga story? Like, oh, she was dressed in a Kanga. So.
Is this the one? Come on.
You wanted it.
Is this the same woman that had HIV? And then
yes.
So Dave, the context behind this is that this woman also had HIV, and he had unprotected sex with this woman. And then the press said to him, "So aren't you worried about getting HIV?" And he said, "Don't worry, I won't get HIV. I had a shower afterwards."
Well, he didn't get it though.
We don't know,
right?
We don't know.
Well, we don't know.
I will say this: the odds of getting HIV from having sex unprotected with someone with HIV once is not as high as people think. I was reading about this. It's actually fairly low, the odds of getting it if you're the, you know, the male. Yeah. So he probably didn't get it. Telling people he definitely didn't get it because he showered, though, definitely caused a lot of people to get AIDS. A lot of people definitely got HIV because they heard the prime minister say, "Don't worry, I took a shower."
President.
That's bad. Yeah, that's, you know, what's funny. Also, the last president, well, of our presidents, the ones who have been accused of rape are pretty extensive. Obama was never accused of a sex crime, though Republicans did pay a mentally ill man to pretend that he was Obama's gay lover and did crack cocaine with him. I don't know if you ever saw that guy. He was in the news when Obama was running in 07 and 08 of this guy who just had, basically they interviewed this guy on these radio shows, and what the radio show interviewer basically ended up saying to him was like, "Look, I believe you had sex with and smoked crack with someone who you very well may think is that guy on TV, but we think maybe you just had sex and smoked crack with a different black guy in Chicago that you are now," because the guy was so clearly mentally ill. It was just like, you know how a lot of people, crazy people, they see someone on TV, they think they know them, you know? I'll say this, there, George H.W. Bush groped a lot of women in his old age. He was known for grabbing asses and anything he could get his hands on in his old age in a wheelchair. If a young woman wanted a picture with him, he would have her bend over down and say, "You know what my favorite book is? David Copperfield." And then he would grab their ass. It was at the point where the Secret Service would discourage women from trying to take a picture with him.
The Secret Service had to intervene.
Yeah. Ronald Reagan was very, very credibly accused of rape in the 60s, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. That was an accusation that I think was very true. A woman that he, you know, this was back in the days when men got away with it all the time anyway. Right before he got married, he raped a woman.
Jeez.
Bill Clinton, Nixon? Of course. Nixon, I think, was never accused of having sex with anyone. No
what,
one would ever.
What happened to Nixon after the impeachment? He just got on that Chinook helicopter and he disappeared. What happened?
You know, Nixon actually had a pretty decent life after that because he was still very respected. He was still very, very intelligent in the Republican circles. You know, the guy was a lunatic and he was a criminal, but he was very smart. He would write articles. He would be interviewed. He was, I remember he was definitely had respect. He wasn't like Trump, where like he was just this hated monster. Yeah. Nixon was really a more tragic kind of character because he was also a drunk and he was paranoid, but he in terms of the job of being president was very good at it. He was very, very intelligent and he was
seriously. Yeah.
He did a lot of great for a Republican president. He did a lot of great things for civil rights just because he happened to be president at a time of change. Yes. And whereas a lot of Trump type Republicans might've stopped it, Nixon was like, "No, this is right. Let's do this." And Nixon did a lot of great things as president and was also a true monster of a human being because he, like Trump, saw himself as the embodiment of the country to the point that running against me as president makes you an enemy of the United States.
Yeah.
That's what was sick about Nixon. Same as Trump.
Yeah. Well,
but the difference is Nixon wasn't an idiot. Nixon wasn't mentally deranged like Trump.
like the crackhead mentally disturbed man from Chicago. That's so funny.
Yeah. You got to see those. Oh, there's lots of interviews with that guy. It's hysterical. The only person, by the way, Roseanne believes them. Roseanne, because she's lost her mind. She would totally endorse this guy's stories. Oh, and by the way, most of the people who have pushed that idea that Obama had this gay crack buddy, most of the people that I've seen push that story also push the idea that Michelle Obama is a man. So we're talking about some really stupid, stupid people.
I just want to know, tell me about the 4th of July.
In general?
No, because there's four things that interest me about U.S. culture.
Uh-huh.
Super Bowl weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And 4th of July.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm happy to talk about them. Is there any, like, are there any specific questions about, like, the differences between them you have or anything, or just?
We'll just tick them off one by one, but we can start with the 4th of July. What is it about the 4th of July that makes Americans not want to be at home? Because everyone that I've seen is not around. They're like, we're in Miami.
That's, I think, more about the fact that we had the pandemic. So this is the first major holiday since it was sort of over for most people. So I think just a lot of people are desperate to get out of town. And everyone's just sort of just been fantasizing about where they're going to travel to for so long. And this was kind of, and 4th of July weekend was literally like it was like America's, this is when we think it'll finally be safe for most people to socialize. Oh. So that's what I think that's about. 4th of July isn't really a leaving town holiday usually. It's a vacation weekend. It's usually like whatever day of the week, like this time it was on a Sunday. So like, whatever, like it's like, usually it makes like a 3-day weekend or a 4-day, like it depending where it lands. And also the reason that 4th of July is so big for Americans is because it's celebrating a military victory, which is what Americans believe themselves to be the best at. So it's a big thing because it's a violence holiday. It's about defeating our close allies, the British, our best friends, the British, and how happy we are that we defeated them. By the way, in Britain, they don't really talk about it. There's not really an acknowledgement. Even when they say like Americans celebrate the 4th of July, they never, even on British news, they never really get into what that date was to them or what they're celebrating.
Yes. Look, there's a lot that, so the British don't celebrate the 4th of July.
I mean, why would they?
So
I don't think the Germans celebrate D-Day.
give me the history of the 4th of July when it comes to Americans. Like, well, historically, where what is the day?
Oh, I mean, the date simply is the day that we commemorate the end of the Revolutionary War, that we commemorate winning the Revolutionary War. I don't know when it became what it is today, when it became like a holiday that's based around the idea of, you know, fireworks and barbecues. That's mostly just sort of because it's in the summer that it's a barbecue holiday. But yeah, it's basically just the, we won a war. We won our first war. And so we're really excited to say that we won our first war against the British, of all people. And it's, yeah, it became, you know, a lot of holidays, you know, they certainly aren't the way we think of them for that long. Christmas, for example, it's fairly recent what we think of as Christmas. Like 150 years ago, people didn't celebrate Christmas in America the way we think of. In fact, I think Christmas was not celebrated in the United States at all for a very long time because it was considered anti-Christian because, you know, Christmas isn't exactly the most orthodox holiday for, you know, for Jesus. So, you know, Christmas only became this, you know, thing we think of as basically just a Thanksgiving type holiday with presents, you know, in fairly recent human history. Thanksgiving, I mean, the funny thing about Thanksgiving is how, and I've had this, and I know a lot of Americans have had this moment where you're told by someone in your family talking about what happened to Indian, to American Indians is not appropriate for Thanksgiving, which is very funny that it is neither the time nor place to talk about the treatment of the American Indians, which is Thanksgiving dinner. The Thanksgiving holiday is probably the biggest holiday in America. Yes. It is our biggest holiday because it's not religious. It's every religion kind of celebrates it.
Oh, and, now it makes sense. You're right. So if it's Christmas, it becomes your early Christmas.
Right. Not everyone in America celebrates Christmas. Only, you know, a little over half of people do, but everyone essentially celebrates Thanksgiving. So it's, you know, Thanksgiving is basically just simply a, well, I mean, holidays exist mostly for obligations toward your family, and Thanksgiving sort of the strongest one where it's just you're expected to be with your family on that day. You know, like I lived in LA for many, many years, but I always was in New York for Thanksgiving because it was just expected of me.
To come back home.
Yeah. 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 Thanksgiving is basically just supposed to be a family specific holiday. Whereas 4th of July is more of a party type it's an outdoor, it's a barbecue party type of time just because of the year, the time of year it is. And you know, the fireworks is just, you know.
Yes, the fireworks. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just because, like I said, we're celebrating a military victory. So we want to, in the same way that Romans would recreate famous battles in the Colosseum to commemorate their wins, in which actual people would die in these recreations of battles inside the Colosseum like a play, America wants actual people to die commemorating our military wins by accidentally killing themselves with fireworks.
You know why I find the 4th of July interesting as well? In South Africa, the 4th of July is when the British finally got revenge on the Zulu nation for the Battle of Isandlwana.
Oh.
So they staged a war against the Zulu nation, and which was led by King Cetshwayo then in the 1800s, lured them in, surrounded them with cannons, and then kidnapped and exiled the king of the Zulu nation. So the 4th of July for us is not a nice day. So I'm thinking, what was the coordinated effort of the British to fuck up the 4th of July in two continents simultaneously over different times?
What's interesting, I'm guessing then that there are a lot of South Africans who assume America is just celebrating that time the British got revenge, which is really, I mean, the pettiness necessary for that, the fact that they must look at us having barbecues and celebrating to talk about that time in the 1800s where another country fucked you up. That's, I can imagine how hurtful that feels when you don't know the backstory. I just assumed the British were like, listen, if we're going to do something that's going to go well for us, for God's sake, let's do it on July 4th. Why was that? You know, the other funny thing about July 4th is twice as many babies are born on the 4th of July as any other date in the United States.
No way.
Yes. And I've heard people say that is a, it's because nature, it's a measure of patriotism that so many babies want to be born on the 4th of July, and not that the sounds of explosions cause spontaneous labor.
Oh, where's Dr. Fauci when you need him? So look, there is a movie also called The 4th of July, right? Born on the 4th of July.
Born on the 4th of July, sure.
Classic movie, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was, I believe, Tom Cruise's first Oscar nomination or win.
Did he ever win anything after that?
I think he might have. I'm not sure. I think he's got like two. But yeah, I think that was his first. He might have gotten one other one. I forget. Magnolia, maybe. But yeah, that was a classic. Yeah, about Vietnam.
Whenever I speak to a comic that's a writer, and which is a transition that I've started making now, recently in the last almost 2 years is I always want to ask, when do you know if an idea is good enough?
I mean, you should, I mean, really, it should simply be a matter of how you feel. But, you know, it's, there's no way of really knowing that. It's just, when you have an idea that's good, you should feel it and not feel like you're cheating, not feel like you're cheating yourself. I think, you know, a lot of comics, you sort of have an idea that when things only fall apart when people get to the point where they're like, I don't think this is good, but the audience will.
Yes.
That's sort of where things go bad. I mean, I think, you know, one of your jobs as a comic is just sort of being able to properly judge whether you're being funny, whether what you're talking about is, that's the main thing, is knowing whether or not, because some people can, like, they can write jokes, but they also don't know when they're being unfunny, and that's just as bad as not being able to write the jokes, because you're ruining your own material.
Yes, you're the obstacle, and you're the heckler in your own set.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you don't all writers want to get to a point where whatever they feel is right, despite what the audience feels, can just go? Because I don't imagine Scorsese feeling like he's going to get turned down by anybody.
Here's the thing, though. I think that that is a very romantic idea that in practice doesn't always work out, because I can think of a lot of artists who got to the point that they stopped caring what the audience thought and it didn't make their work better. An example of that, Tenet. The new movie from, what is it?
Joshua Greaves.
Sorry, who was it? Yeah, Christopher Nolan, yeah. Christopher Nolan's new movie, Tenet, seemed to me like a perfect example of someone who got too in love with his own ideas and ended up making something that no one really enjoyed, because I felt like he got too wrapped up in his own kind of world and it just didn't work anymore. I think David Lynch did the same thing, where it's like you get too pretentious, you get too indulgent in your own stuff. Wonder Woman 84, perfect example. Everyone said that when Wonder Woman 84 was about to come out, they were saying that, like, Patty's, you know, that her vision was that the first movie, the studio had all these notes and all this control. And then the second movie, she got to do the movie she wanted to do. And then everyone said, oh, you shouldn't have done the movie you wanted to do. Because a lot of times, just, you know, you, when it's too focused, one person's vision, it doesn't work as well. So I think that, like, we see comics. I can think of comedians who got too in love with their own voice and started thinking, I don't even need to be funny. I'm so compelling. I can just talk. And I don't think that works.
Yes. Yes. And it's always characterized by the by the throwaway play with the microphone stand, or just kicking your one foot behind, you know, on the wall, or saying something like, guys, I just came here to hang out. You know, I just thought, let me just come spend time with you. I think for me, those are the telltale signs that this plane is going to crash.
Yeah, there's this kind of like when they get so much confidence, because there's a thing that, like, that I forgot who it said, like, when you stop being nervous, you should stop doing it. And like when they stop being nervous and they start having that level of confidence in themselves, they stop having that kind of, there should be a level of desperation.
Yes.
To please this audience. And I think when you don't have that, things get dangerous.
Yes. What do you think are the humility mechanisms that creatives sometimes can use when they've reached that level of success? Because sometimes you have all the things that you want, right? You have the Oscar, you have the Emmy nominations, you have the money. What is the one thing that you can do to kind of keep yourself? Because I see it with huge comics. You know, you see it on the Instagram posts, playing the humble squire, you know, struggling comic vibe on some, I'm going to go there with my hoodie on. But you're like, we know you're not struggling. So what is the motivation still?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happens, is a lot of people get to a point where they wanted to be and they're no longer hungry. And for a lot of people, their comedy came because of that emotion of the desperation they had. And not everyone can continue creating once they lose that. Some people can. But yeah, you kind of have to not believe in yourself. You have to not think you're that great. You have to like think, you have to have the attitude of like a champion in like a fight where you're like, I need to be the best possible to stay here. Some people get there and they think, oh, I can relax. And other people get there and they think, all right, now I really need to work hard to maintain this. And that's what you have to. You have to be constantly, you know, worried that you're going to lose everything.
I think that attitude. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because I can think of so many comedians who, and we know who they are, just kind of got to a place and said, all right, I'm not going to work hard anymore. Don't worry about the script. Once the camera's on me, I'm just going to be hilarious. Just put the camera on me and I can be funny just the way I say words. We don't even have to worry about writing jokes. Yeah. I've seen so many movies like that. You can tell exactly who it is. And you're like, yep, you squandered everything you built up.
How did you fight that from happening when you guys were working on the King of Staten Island? Because that for me is a future classic.
No, thank you.
That movie is going to be, for me, is right up there with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, because that's one of my favorite movies. And I'm like, that's a movie I can watch over and over and over again.
Well, that was the whole thing of that movie, was just trusting Judd and his process of putting together everything we were writing in a way that would feel real. Because it's a much more grounded movie than he's done before. It's more realistic. And that, you know, we had to sacrifice a lot of jokes we wanted to do to keep that kind of feeling, to keep it real, to keep it grounded. Whereas, you know, left to our own devices, you know, me and Pete would have written just a nonstop, you know, joke engine that tried to tell that same story, but it wouldn't have been nearly as engaging, I think. It would have been, you know, would have more jokes, but it wouldn't have had the same connection. I think but that's also because Judd Apatow, he wasn't thinking this is going to be great because I did it. He was thinking, oh my God, I have to make this good or my entire, you know, career will be tainted by, you know, this. Not, that's the kind of attitude you need to have, that everyone is just thinking, oh Jesus Christ, if this is bad, we're all so screwed. Like when the movie came out and did good, people asked what that felt like, you know, to have a movie coming out. And I said, the honest truth, it felt like watching a bullet whiz right past your head.
Really?
It felt like watching a bullet just miss you.
Explain.
That's what it feels like, because it didn't fail. It didn't ruin our lives.
You didn't connect. You didn't die.
Yeah. That's what having a successful movie is. Being shot at and missing.
What I've always been attracted to stories that are coming of age stories. And this one caught me by surprise, because I thought I would relate more. When I saw the trailer, I thought I would relate more to the character that Pete Davidson plays, but I didn't expect feeling a lot for Bill Burr's character or Pete's mom.
Yeah, well, they
and
both...
I guess that's getting older, right? The emotion of understanding and seeing where the other person who is... When you're 20, someone who's 40 is ancient.
Yeah.
You know? Your mom could be 40 when you're 20, 19 and dating, and you're like, what the fuck is this guy doing at my house? But when you reach 39, 40, you're the guy. You're the creepy old man in some young kid's house. And it's up to you to embrace them or reject them. It's not for them to embrace you or reject you. It's up to you to embrace them or reject them.
Yep. Well, I mean, Bill and Marissa just did such amazing jobs of acting in this, that they really made these characters that connected. I mean, I thought, you know, both of them really were, they really grounded the whole movie. It really helps so much to have people who can make your writing so much better the way they both did. And because we were just really trying to make this honest. We were just really trying to make this a real story, that there was nothing about it that felt affected, that felt like forced. Yes. And that's, you know, that's a big thing with Judd, is, you know, he doesn't want to force anything. He doesn't want to make things happen for a joke. He really wants things to feel, everything that happens here feels like it's in a reality that makes sense.
Yes. Like the camera just happened to be on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And no, Bill and Marissa were just so goddamn good at making these characters and making you feel like what they're dealing with is real. And I think a lot of people, if you don't have the kind of problems that Pete, you know, his character has, yes, you probably deal with someone who does. Yes. And like a lot of people know what it's like to deal with someone who doesn't want to be a burden on their family, but is.
Yes. That's so deep. And I think in where we find ourselves in our society right now with mental health and fears that people have, we take for granted that sometimes being successful in your own little way is a fear itself, you know, because he struggles to try and make himself look as good as he could be. And he hides behind mediocrity in that little way of his. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, success is very scary to people, you know, because depression, not having anything to live for is oddly comforting. And yeah, having a lot to lose is more than a lot of people with anxiety can really handle.
Yes.
It's very comforting, right, to have nothing. It's very comforting to just,
yes,
wrap,
yes,
yourself in nothing and feel safe than, yes, to always have to acknowledge that a mistake is going to cost me a lot.
You know, when I was younger, I never understood why the 12th grade was the hardest grade that people go through. Because when you're growing up, you're always made to feel like academically, that's the most challenging it's ever going to be for your school career. This way you get tested if you're going to leave this place or not. But actually, it's the anxiety of leaving everything you've known for the last 12, 14 years. The institutionalization, mm-hmm, of it all, the friends that you have built, you know, your transition that you've made from teenagehood to now this adult that's going to be thrusted out there in the world without the full experience and the ability of being an adult. And that's what makes you hold on to that 12th grade. You know, that's what brings the nerves. The exam signifies the end of it all. You know, now you're, mm-hmm, being put out there to fend for yourself and deal with life as it is. And you know nothing of it because for 12 years, you are part of an institution, you know, that told you how to dress and when to show up, when to party, and when to study, and all of a sudden so much is expected of you. So your measure of success and failure is almost always hanging by a thread. And I think that that's when the anxiety is born for most young adults, right? That's when it was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly think that anxiety, people with anxiety had been feeling it way before that. These are people who every day at school was a roller coaster. But I think, how do I put this? I think that like we get very, you know, worried about those moments because it's very difficult for certain jobs, certain kind of careers, because it's like that where you put all this time into something and in 1 second, you're going to know if it was wasted or not. It's very odd. You know, that's when you make a movie, you're spending 2 years on something that you're going to find out in 1 day is either good or bad. Or it's like being a prize fighter where you're training all this time and you could just then lose this fight. It was all wasted. It was all for nothing. Yes. And it's a lot of stress to have any kind of life where it's a lot of time and then one test to see if all that time was completely for nothing. And that's really hard.
I think the closest anybody feels with that is being an athlete, being an Olympian. I once heard an Olympian swimmer saying, I trained 4 years for one 30-second race. And I've trained my whole lifetime for possibly 4 30-second races in my whole entire career.
Right. That's got to be insane. That the emotional dump of once you've done that and now it's over and everything you've been building up to is over. I mean, how do you deal with that? How do you live with yourself when you're 22 and your life is over? Not even like in a bad way, but it's just like, well, everything you've lived for, you lived for this and now it happened. Yes. So.
And it's all you know.
Go start over. Go start a new life. Yeah.
Yes. And it's all you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, just people hate change, even if they hate what is being changed.
Yeah. You know, though, if there's one thing I've realized about writing, because I taught myself, really, because when I started doing stand-up, I didn't really believe in writing. I just always believed if the idea sticks in my head long enough, then I'll say it enough times for it to become permanent in my mind. And when it stops being funny to me, I'll stop saying it. But with writing is you almost start with one idea, and then you get to have characters in the idea that you've always wanted to have. And then you start falling in love with characters that you never gave attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So I wrote this pitch for a show called, a movie called, a script for a movie called The Puck Shop Boys, right? Josh knows about this. So The Puck Shop Boys, about in South Africa in 1994, that's when democracy came. Nelson Mandela became president. But it was the first time that schools became integrated. So now you've got these township kids that started going to a low-income white neighborhood school, but for their first year of high school. First year of high school, first day of high school is 1994. They get to go to the school and deal with all of this. But when I was coming up with a concept before I even put it down on paper, I was always talking from the point of view of those kids getting into that bus every morning with adults that are going to work in the white neighborhood. And I never thought of the kids in that neighborhood and the adults in that neighborhood and what the integration and the change meant for them. And so these kids meet up with this one kid who is biracial, lives with his mom who is black in the low income suburb, but then goes to the township over the weekends. But he met these three boys when he was taking the bus on a Monday back to school with his mom, who was also going back to work. But they would meet at the shop, right? Which is owned by a Portuguese man, Mr. Dos Santos. And they would play video games there. And this is the 90s, Miss Pac-Man, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, all these games. So that's the love of games brought them together, but not in the cliche way, because that was our story. That was my story growing up. And I put so much emphasis on that memory of mine as a kid growing up, that video games at the corner shop got me through life. But then when I started going deeper and thinking about this Portuguese man in this neighborhood who also didn't feel like he belonged because it was a white Afrikaans neighborhood and he's Portuguese. And here come these black kids that come play there. He gave them shelter and refuge, you know, from waiting for the bus in the morning or waiting for school to open because they got there so early. But I never thought in my head I would fall in love with the biracial kid's real dad, who happened to be his mom's boss. I never thought I'd fall in love with Mr. Dos Santos and the tragic story of his wife dying of a robbery. I never thought of that. I never thought I'd empathize with the men and women getting into the bus, spending the best time of their youth and their years, getting into a bus and just going to work and commuting for almost 4 hours a day. And that emotionally was very cathartic for me, because I felt like while I was worried too much about what am I going to do after high school, there was this big world that existed parallel to me, like almost like a parallel universe.
You know, it's funny. One of the things when I started writing King of Staten Island was Judd had me read the writer of Deadwood and read some of his lectures that he gave about writing. And he talks about that sort of, the way that, like, as you start writing, you start creating these worlds and falling in love with these characters. And then it becomes this thing where it's like, these are fully fleshed out people in your mind that you're trying to be honest with ourselves about who these people are, how they would react. And then just sort of seeing like, okay, well then when something gets thrown into the scenario and shakes everything up, how would these people act? Who are these people? And I think the more you learn about this person from you getting deeper into who they are, the more attached you become. And then it becomes the even cooler idea of, and then as a writer, you're going to have to get to the point where you're going to have to scale that back and be like, okay, I do love this person, but I think they have to die. That sort of thing. You kind of get to that point.
Yes. Yes. Because when you're right, whenever you're watching a show, you absolve yourself from responsibility.
Yeah.
You literally look at any character, how they dress, how they behave, how they're conducting themselves, and where they might end up. And then you go, I am not responsible for this. All of this that you're doing here is your own doing. If you end up being killed, your fault. If you end up being this broke, it's your fault. But when you're writing, you're right. You take it upon yourself to see them succeed, although you know that they're not supposed to succeed. But I'm saying for those that don't need to, like the bad guy. But I mean, you almost want him to score a victory somewhere, right?
Right. I mean, the truth is that like when I've written with people or I've, you know, in different times I help with people with their writing, one of the things that you run into a lot is this instinct people have to make things be okay, where we have this instinct where we don't want conflict. And I'm like, no, you're writing a story. You have to have conflict. And, you know, I'll be writing something and so you might suggest something that's like a lot of people will get afraid of these big changes to a story of these major events. And you have to stop people and be like, look, without this, what's the story? Why are people watching this if not for something transformative happening? And I think that a lot of people have this instinct where they're like, no, we'll just like you, the tent, like a lot of, this is what I've noticed. You can't be a good writer if you're afraid of tension. And some writers are afraid of letting tension build. They don't like it because you're not supposed to like it. You're supposed to use it. It's a tool to make people feel a certain way. You know, a perfect example of that is a lot of people hate the movie Uncut Gems.
Oh, man.
Because they can't handle
the tension,
the fact that it works so well. They can't handle that it's doing such a good job of manipulating their sense of tension. And I think a lot of people have this. I've seen people write, well, they write scripts where it's just like you're letting everyone off the hook. You're not letting this build. You're not letting the conflict. You're not letting this get, you're not letting the stakes be high enough because you fell in love with your character so much that you want to protect them. You can't.
Yes. That's what I was saying. You nailed it absolutely. And I sometimes get stuck right in the middle of it because I feel like that. I feel like I've created this person somewhere and now I can't let them down. I feel like they depend on me.
Right.
I know it's crazy.
And here's the worst thing about it is that now what's going to happen is you start to see yourself in some of these characters because you wrote this about your own childhood, right?
Yes.
Now, here's the problem. A lot of people will have this problem in writing, especially when they're writing something based on themselves, and especially if they're going to play the character that they're writing, is suddenly people kind of want to make themselves a little bit too cool. And you have to be there. And in the writing room, you have to kind of be like, you know what? I think he should do something really horrible. And then, you know, you might get someone to be like, well, no, like this happens with actors all the time. Where the actors always want their character to be a badass and they want it to be perfect. They don't want him to have these horrible flaws that are necessary for the person to grow from. And you have to start telling people like, no, I think your character should, I think we should all hate him now. I think he should do something we hate. And then he has to win us back. And you know, an actor very, very likely might just be like, well, no, I wanted him to be awesome. You know, and they might misjudge how people would interpret them doing certain things or, you know, like they might think the people are too much. Like I've often said to people also, it's just like, don't forget the audience is not going to be on your side if you don't deserve it. They're not just on your side because you're the star of this movie. You know, the character, just because the character is the main character doesn't mean they're going to be on your side. You have to show them why we should be with this person. And you know, another thing I run into a lot with people's writing is everyone with comedy, everyone's always trying to break the reality for one joke. And you can't do that. Like everyone's always, because comedy is about breaking tension. So everyone always wants to like contradict the whole reality of the fact this is a movie to get one joke off the tension of we're watching a movie. And I'm like, yeah, but once you've done that, no one cares about this movie anymore. No one believes they're watching a real story anymore.
Yes, and that's what King of Staten Island did so well.
Right, there was no winks. There was no winking to the audience. There was
no.
This is fake. This is a story. It was really like, we're going to really, really pull you in and try to make you truly believe this world.
You know, when you say that winking to the audience, I think of, I can't think of names right now, but you know, in the 90s, it was popular to have those movies where someone who just go off to camera like they do in House of Cards and starts while the scene is happening, they go, I know what you're probably thinking right now. You're like, yay! So it became so popular then that now we are so attracted to unstable shots and totally being ignored and almost feeling like a fly on the wall whenever a movie is happening. Am I saying it right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the unstable shot thing really kind of comes from the mockumentary style because it makes the audience sort of oddly trust what they're seeing more. It makes them feel more like I'm just seeing something real, like a reality show. And there's a very weird thing that human beings do, which is a lot of people, and it's not exactly a measure of intelligence, they don't watch anything scripted because they've lost the intellectual ability to suspend their disbelief. They only watch reality TV, which is also completely scripted and fake, but because they actually believe it's real, there's no work for them to do. There's no mental gymnastics. And it's very depressing to think that anyone out there considers watching a sitcom too much work.
You know, for me, what I consider a masterclass of television till this day is always going to be The Sopranos.
Sure. Yeah, Sopranos is a very, very well-made show and a great example of a show where they had that game where they're like, okay, you like this character? Let's see how many horrible things you can do and see if you still like him. Which I find depressing because I think we learned in those days that like audiences are just way too tolerant of someone whose point of view we see, and they'll just sort of be on the side of a person. Like with Tony Soprano, it was like, this is a decent guy in a crazy situation who, you know, is a product of his environment. And he was evil in many ways, but he was also redeemable because, you know, we were examining who he is. But then, like, I feel like over the years, we've kind of gone too far with that because there are shows like You on Netflix, a show called You, that honestly just seems like a celebration of a rapist serial killer. It's a point of view of a typical serial killer. He's not a rapist, but his modus operandi is exactly what people like the Golden State Killer, famous rapist serial killers, acted like. And people watch this and they love him. And it's like, what are you doing? Why are you making a show built around the idea that that the worst person in the world is the hero in this reality? And it's because it's like people will, if you're the main character and it's your point of view, a lot of people will just go with it. And it's weird. It's sad that because I've talked to people like watch the show You, and I'm like, do you want him to get away with these things? Or are you, because I watched one episode when someone made me watch it and I was like, I feel like I'm not supposed to be watching it the way I am. The whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, God, I wish someone would just bash his brains in with a pipe. I wish a cop would just shoot him in the face. I wish he would just wake up on Dexter's table about to be slaughtered, and that's the Dexter reboot. And I'm like, people watch this hoping this guy gets away with this? Like, he's killing people because he's stalking a woman. Why is he the hero here? And then the makers of the show would be like, no, that's not how you're supposed to get. I'm like, I'm enough of a writer that I can tell when you're clearly framing the reality around us being on his side. Like, I know you're pretending and not, but I'm telling you, we're supposed to be on his side. And that really, that really offends me.
But don't you think
that, and then they gave him a Jewish name, made it even worse.
What was it?
I don't know, but the guy's name is a traditionally Jewish name. And look, I know that there have been plenty of Jewish serial killers, but
have there been?
Yeah, enough. Well, let's see. Hold on. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know how many. I know Berkowitz, David Berkowitz obviously was. I'm sure there's others. Joel Rifkin was in Long Island. I don't know what his religion was, but he was in Long Island.
You know, when you talk about that show that you're talking about now and wanting the guy to lose, it was actually the genius of the emotional manipulation that The Sopranos got us. Because whenever you watch mobster documentaries, they always tell you about how smart Luciano was. And if he wasn't in the underworld, he would have become a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. There was none of that with Tony. Tony yeah. was not, you never see, you. We never ever felt like Tony can do anything else. Yeah. We never felt like there was an out for him.
Tony wasn't a genius. He was just sort of crafty and he was a clever guy. But, and I think like we pretend that these old gangsters were geniuses, but I don't know how much they, like Al Capone was an idiot. I don't even know. Like Al Capone was famously really stupid. He was a janitor, you know, in prison, but like Al Capone was not a smart man. He had a very low IQ. He was just a thug. And he, you know, I think we have this idea of who these people are. Like Meyer Lansky, we think of as this super genius. And it's like, yeah, was he a genius or was he just the best at math of all these high school dropouts? Of all the-
Oh, man, that's funny.
If they were real, I feel like the real geniuses, we wouldn't even know their names.
that sounds like there should be a show where everyone who was made a hero in those situations was taken away from the roles that they're famous for and put in real life and see how they would have struggled. Because you don't become a thug because you're the smartest person around.
Yeah, no, I'd love to see Lucky Luciano at a Fortune 500 company trying to trying to figure out search engine visibility.
Oh, Meyer Lansky at the stock market.
Yeah, well, actually, I feel like Meyer might have been good at that. He might have actually been great at like scamming people with junk bonds. You don't know that, so maybe I don't know. You know, there was a lot of Wall Street scams back in those days too.
What are you working on now? What's gotten you excited?
I got a couple of projects I'm working on. One is a movie that we're working on right now. Another is a TV show that is, I might actually, oddly enough, that one I might be on camera for, which is weird for me. And then I'm also working on something, my own sitcom. That's something based on my, sort of based on my childhood.
Well, can you talk about it yet? Or is it still under wraps?
Not really. I can't, there's certain things I'm just not really supposed to talk about publicly until they're sold. But, which I probably should have told you as you were explaining your movie idea to me.
luckily we're not live. So
yeah. Yeah.
Trevor's not
basically. The one I'm working on myself is sort of just, it's an what I wanted to do was an examination of our pet, like the way culture's changed over the last like 30 years, like what the 80s and 90s were, you know, and what that would, how stark that would look to someone from today.
Yes.
And it also wanted to just do a sort of an exact, I wanted to get into the idea of like who we would be if we had to relive our lives without getting too much into it.
Yes, I 100% get you. I 100% get you.
Yeah, so I'm trying to work on that. We'll see how that goes.
Oh man, best of luck with that. I feel like we need
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm going to have to hang out with a bunch of children to like get a feel for the dialogue.
Yes.
And just, you know,
and know exactly what they're talking about now, right? Because yeah, it does, you know, feel foreign. My daughter's tough.
Yeah, you want to just, yeah, you want to like get a good feel for like how the dialogue would sound.
Yes.
When like it's like little kids, because they have a very specific way of speaking. It changes constantly.
Yes.
Then you, and it's, like, and it's also, those are kids today, not kids from the 80s, but you know, you sort of look for the combination.
I love this convo. I want Josh to, in the future, in a few months or so, arrange another interview so we can have more chats about your writing on SNL and what you're working on now. Probably would have been far along, because I feel like now we've just touched a lot on on the stuff that.
Yeah, you know? That's the thing. I can't really talk about this in the future.
I know.
But there's also, I mean, I just did a show on Fox called Let's Be Real. It was a puppet sketch show on Fox I was really proud of. It had no advertising, so no one knows it existed, but it was there. And we also have a cartoon coming out next year called Fired on Mars, which is like it's about corporate culture and Mars colonies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we have that coming out as well. So that's coming out. That's something we've already worked on, Fired on Mars. And you can check out Let's Be Real either on Hulu or Fox, if wherever you have access to. That's a political current events puppet sketch show. We made puppets of like Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Trump, Pence, Taylor Swift, Shaquille O'Neal, Stephen A. Smith, lots of people.
I can't wait to check it out.
That's fun.
Oh, man, Dave, you've been such an awesome guest. Thank you so much, man, for making
time. Thank you. This has been very fun. I appreciate coming on.